Tales from the Vault is a production of the NFL in partnership with iHeartRadio. Welcome to NFL Films Tales from the Vault. I'm your host, Andrea Kramer. In 1984, I started my Hall of Fame career at NFL Films as a producer, and Steve Sable was my boss. Steve was a creative genius, a brilliant cinematographer, and by now, if you've listened to this podcast, you know he's an expert interviewer. And by the way, if you haven't been listening, where the heck have you been? But look, this podcast showcases some of the greatest interviews that Steve Sable ever did. Raw, unedited conversations, none of which have ever been heard before in their entirety. My role? Well, I'm here to guide you through them, providing context, insight, and share some of my own experiences along the way. Today, we head to the vault for a very special interview, Steve Sable's 1986 conversation with the late John Madden. In 1986, John Madden was 8 years into his broadcasting career with CBS, established as the top announcer in the NFL. Already a commercial sensation, but not yet a video game icon. Now, remember how I mentioned that I'm going to share some of my own experiences with you in this podcast? Well, this one is particularly special to me because I got to work with Coach, and yes, that's what we all called him. I worked with Coach over the course of my 30-plus year career, including 3 years together on NBC's Sunday Night Football. But when I was starting out as a producer turned reporter at NFL Films, there was a memorable interview that I did with Coach Madden back in 1988. So we're happy to bring you some extra Madden bonus content.
How do you reconcile that the Raiders have a dirty label?
Well, I think that was, that was good. That was something that we never fought. I think part of that went with Oakland, the Coliseum, the silver and black, the helmets, the whole thing. And that's what your persona becomes, and it's going to be that. So why not capitalize and say, okay, yeah, people believe that. Yeah. I mean, they want to say the Raiders are dirty. Yeah, we're dirty. What are you going to do about it?
Boy, you really miss that kind of honesty in today's media landscape. But I remember there was a quote at the end of the interview that I loved where Coach was talking about not getting his players too hyped up before a game. It's better to hear it from his mouth, not just my paraphrase.
I am so hyper, I'm going to get them all hyper, and they're going to go out there expending too much nervous energy before. I mean, you don't let out your hose till you know where the fire is. And I didn't want them to be letting out their hose 2 hours before. We didn't get to the fire yet.
Coach certainly had a way with words, metaphors, and imagery. But today's podcast features the interview that Steve did with John Madden back in 1986. He asks him about all those famous Raiders plays, including the Holy Roller, the Immaculate Reception, the Sea of Hands. But Steve also talks to Coach about Raiders legends like Al Davis, Kenny Stabler, and Gene Upshaw. But he starts off asking Madden a philosophical question because who better to discuss football philosophy with than John Madden? And again, this has a unique connection to yours truly. In 1986, I was a writer and editor on a show called Autumn Ritual. It's like a cult film, and to this day, it remains one of the most influential and meaningful productions of my career. The show examined the essence of football from a viewpoint outside the arena, and there were voices of a lot of non-football types, a poet, a musician, dancer, politician, writers, but they also needed some football people in the show too. And even though John Madden was more famously known for his bluster and emotional reactions, he was also extremely thoughtful and, of course, a masterful storyteller. So that's where we start off as we head to the vault for Steve Sable and John Madden.
John, we're doing a program called Autumn Ritual, and we're using a lot of theologians and sociologists and anthropologists. We have Andy Warhol and Norman Mailer and Baryshnikov, and everybody's giving their impressions of pro football. And one anthropologist we interviewed talked about the condition that a warrior would have to get in before he would go on a hunt or into battle, and making a correlation between the mental state that it's necessary to play professional football, relating that to going into war or to combat. Do you think that that's a valid?
Yeah, I think that's something. I think that that's something that every athlete in every sport worries about, or at least in the combative sports, that you don't go around hitting and being aggressive and being hit. But at the moment when someone rings a bell or blows a whistle, you have to kick that attitude in. And you hope that it always does, because you can't test it. You know, I mean, a fighter, if he's going to fight on Friday night, he can't go around on Thursday night to see if it's there, because he's not fighting Thursday night. And you don't go around, because it's not natural, a lot of things that you do in contact. So you hope that whatever it is, that when you're ready to play the game, that it kicks in, and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, and sometimes they just can't get it. And that's where a guy gets scared. And that's usually when they start getting out of the game. It's a very dangerous thing. That it's an attitude, it's a different thing, it's a different personality. And when you walk onto that field or across that line, it has to kick in, because it's not always there.
Is there anything that you could do for that, John?
No, there's nothing, because it's not something that's manufactured. It's something that has to be, and if it's not there, there's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing you can do. I mean, if it doesn't come in, if it doesn't kick, you know, if it's just, you know, part of an attitude, or a guy, you know, you could get him upset and get him upset with you, and maybe, but that attitude of where hitting is fun and hitting feels good and being hit feels good, I mean, you get to that, but it's not natural, and it doesn't come naturally. You just hope that it comes. I mean, you ask any player, you know, you can talk about before what they do and going into what they do, but you ask them about watching films, and they don't know it. They don't know. I mean, they don't know that they're doing it until they're watching a film. And that thing that has to kick in is that attitude that getting hit doesn't hurt. And it really doesn't. At that time, it doesn't hurt. I mean, you watch a boxing match. I mean, how those guys take those punches and they don't hurt. But whatever that is, it's there. And the football player, I mean, the guy runs and he gets those collisions, you know, and gets hit and spun around and knocked back and head and just gets up and walks back and it doesn't hurt.
John,
but it would hurt the next day. And then they watch film. They don't even know what happened to them.
One of the most publicized things about yourself is why you quit coaching. But to go back and do a feature on yourself, what did you enjoy most about coaching? That's something
I enjoyed the games. That was the fun. I mean, if there's anything I missed, it was a game. I didn't, and then you take everything back, you know, from that gets to be non-enjoyable. And I enjoyed the games on Sunday and the big games, you know, where you were going and, you know, you're going in and playing the Pittsburgh Steelers in Pittsburgh. I loved it, you know. Over the years, one night was Kansas City, you know, in Kansas City, or even Oakland or Miami. You know, the big games, the traditional ones, the rivalry run. We had it with the Jets, you know, with Namath. Those are fun. I mean, that was really fun. That was really fun. And then the other games, I liked the other games. The other stuff, you just get tired of it. I mean, things like, you know, practice and meetings and watching film and the draft and, you know, media and all that stuff. The games were always fun.
How would you react to this statement? There was a famous sports psychologist that did an analysis of successful football coaches, and he said that when you look at the mental profile of a successful football coach, you're not necessarily looking at the profile of an entirely healthy person. Do you think there's something to say in relating it to your own experience?
Yeah, you know, I mean, as myself, I mean, if they're talking about me, I would agree with that. I look at Don Shula and Tom Landry and Chuck Knoll, and I marvel at them. I really do. I mean, because they've done it well, and they've done it over a long period of time, and I have no idea how they've done it. And I think that they're well. I mean, I think that they are. I would, you know, I mean, the things that you do, you drive yourself, and a lot of it's superstition. You know, I mean, a lot of it starts with, we win a big game against Kansas City. On Wednesday night, we worked on our offensive game plan. We finished it. We worked until 2 in the morning. Now you beat Kansas City, so now it's next week, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. You say, well, we're tired, we ought to go home. You say, well, last week we worked until 2, and we had a good game plan, so you stay until 2. You do something, and then you want to do it better, so better thinks longer, and pretty soon you're putting in such long hours that you get to vegetate, and it's not right, and you build up a lot of things you believe that has to be done, and if you do them, then they're really taking everything out of you. And if you don't do them, then you feel guilty for not doing them.
John, I want to change the train of thought here. With yourself, we have so many great shots of you on the sidelines and how emotional you were. You think that was, a lot of people would say, well, how can he think clearly like that? And the coach is always going to be the placid, you know. Was that something that was that you felt was a drawback in your ability?
No, I could always think. I mean, the thing that I had the ability to do was get mad, but what I was doing was just reacting to what happened at the moment. But then that reaction would go away, and I could always think the next thing. I was always thinking ahead anyway. And some of the things that I did were just reactions, but they were reactions that didn't last for a long time. I mean, I still do that. I've always been there. I mean, I can get mad at someone, but I don't stay mad. I mean, I can get real mad right now, and then 5 seconds later, I'm not mad anymore. But I've always, when it comes, I've always let it go out, you know, not hold it in. And that was the way that I coached, and I didn't do it. I mean, I didn't know that I do. You know, I talked about players seeing themselves in films doing. I used to see pictures of myself and believe that I didn't do that. I mean, I couldn't have done that. I don't remember doing that. I didn't think about it. I didn't, you know, premeditate that I was going to do it. It just came out as a reaction. But it was a quick reaction. Then it would be over, and then it would be on to the next thing.
There were a couple of things the coach said that really resonated for me. Remember, Madden never had a losing season as a head coach. He lasted 10 years. In fact, he felt that was the expiration date for a head coach. So it's interesting to hear him laud Don Shula, Tom Landry, and Chuck Knoll for coaching over a long period of time. And then there were some things that he said that carry over directly from coaching to broadcasting. For example, he talked about how he enjoyed the games, especially the rivalry ones. But he also mentioned practice, meetings, and watching film. Things that he added to the preparation process for his broadcast that were never done before. We would watch film on Friday afternoons, conduct production meetings with players and coaches, and of course, go to the home team's practice. And then there was what Madden said about always thinking ahead and having a quick reaction. Qualities that helped him as a head coach, but also to excel as an analyst. When we come back, Madden recalls some of the most famous games in Raiders history, including his conspiracy theory on the Immaculate Reception. Welcome back to Tales from the Vault. You know, they just don't make games with names like they used to. I mean, we just had that incredible Kansas City-Buffalo divisional playoff game, and they're calling it the 13-second game? I mean, come on. That is not a nickname commensurate with this kind of instant classic. I mean, games with names defined the 70s. What do I mean? Well, think of the Holy Roller, the Immaculate Reception, the Sea of Hands, the Ghost to the Post. And what's one thing all those games had in common? John Madden and the Oakland Raiders.
One of the most memorable moments in NFL history in the Holy Roller. Is there anything that you remember when I just mentioned that to you about that play?
Yeah, the big thing about that play is just before the play, we had a timeout, which was our last timeout. And Ken Stabler came over to the sideline, and we talked about the play, the pass that we were going to call, the play we were going to run. And after that, the last thing I remember telling him is, look, we don't have any more timeouts, so you can't take a sack. You have to get rid of the ball. I said, no matter what happened, if there's nothing open, throw the ball away. Get rid of the ball. You can't take the sack because there's no timeouts to save it. So then, of course, he started the play. The rush came upon him. He knew that he couldn't take the sack because if he took the sack, the game's over. There's no timeout. So he started to take the sack and then remembered he couldn't take the sack, so he just put the ball down. And then guys kept picking it up and running it in, and the next thing I know, it was a touchdown.
10 seconds left. Oakland trails 20-14. The crowd takes up a chant of defense. Robisky and Banaszak are the backs. Slot right. Branch inside. Taylor back. Here comes the rush. He sidesteps. Can he throw? He can't. The ball flipped forward is loose. A wild scramble. 2 seconds on the clock. Casper grabbing the ball. It is rolled a fumble. Casper has recovered in the end zone. The Oakland Raiders have scored on the most zany, unbelievable, absolutely impossible dream of a play. Stabler, while being hit, the ball squirted forward. Madden is on the field. He wants to know if it's real. They said, yes, get your big butt out of here. He does.
What was your immediate reaction to it? Did you think it was, did you celebrate right away?
No, I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I saw the ball down, and I knew that time, that if we recovered, whoever got the ball before it went in the end zone, if anyone did, the game's over, because there's no time. And so I'm just hoping that it just keeps on going, that it never gets over. And then finally, when Casper falls on it, I know he's in the end zone. I know that if they rule everything else legal, that it's a touchdown. So I didn't know it was a touchdown, so I was running out to find out, one, if it was a touchdown, and two, if they said it wasn't, I was going to argue the case, whatever reason I could think of quickly, that it was.
There's nothing real in the world anymore. The Raiders won the football game. The Chargers are standing, looking at each other, looking at the sky. They don't believe it. Nobody believes it. I don't know if the Raiders believe it. It's not real. A man would be a fool to ever try and write a drama and make you believe it. This one will be relived forever.
The other play that you were involved in, and you told me once several years ago, you had an interesting story about the Immaculate Reception, about what happened after the play.
Well, the thing about that play that bothered me then, bothers me today, and will bother me until the day I die, is that in the history of football, when a guy crosses a goal line, it's either a touchdown or it's not. This time, they, you know, had the whole thing. Franco Harris runs in. They didn't call a touchdown. They didn't know if it was a touchdown. Now, they all went out, and they had their little meeting. And I went out, and I was part of the meeting. And it was at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh, and everyone else was out there in the field. And they said, get away. We don't know what happened. And I knew that they didn't know what happened. And I was out there to tell them what happened, because they didn't know, and I may as well put in my thing. So anyway, so now they don't know. So now the referee leaves that huddle, which was in the end zone, and he goes over to the dugout on the Pittsburgh Steelers side, and he gets on the phone, and he makes a call to someone, and I still don't know who he made the call to, because I won't admit it. Then he hangs up, then he walks out into the middle of the field and says, touchdown, 5 or 10 minutes later. And then they said that they didn't look at replays. They didn't do anything. So Marv Hubbard had a thing about that. Marv Hubbard said what the guy did is they thought it was illegal, and they wanted to, the officials wanted to get out of the joint. So the guy went over and said, do you have a helicopter that can get us out of here? And the guy said, no. And he said, okay, touchdown Steelers. I don't know, but I still don't know. No one knows. Of all the investigations and investigative reporters, no one knows, one, who that guy talked to and what was said on that telephone call. And my whole point was, not whether it was legal or not, but if you didn't know when it happened, how'd you find out that it was a touchdown? That's all. I still ask that. That question has never been answered to this day. You go ask someone. They don't know.
22 seconds remaining. And Bradshaw back and looking again. Bradshaw running out of the pocket, looking for somebody to throw to, fires it downfield. And there's a collision. It's caught out of the air. The ball is pulled in by Franco Harris. Harris is going for a touchdown for Pittsburgh. Franco Harris pulled in the football. I don't even know where it came from. Fuqua was in a collision. There are people in the end zone. Where did he come from? Absolutely unbelievable. Holy moly.
1974 playoff, Raiders-Dolphins. Any recollection, what your recollections of that game were?
I'll never forget, that was in Oakland. And the Dolphins at that time, had that hanky bit, you know, the white handkerchief where you go down there and they'd all wave those handkerchiefs when it started. So the Raider fans, or however those things started, they were going to wave black handkerchiefs. And when we came out for that game, there was more excitement in the stadium than I ever heard anywhere or felt anywhere. And everyone had a black handkerchief. And from the pregame warm-ups, they were wired in Oakland. They were great fans anyway. And they were really wired this day. We were playing the Dolphins, and it was going to be big. So anyway, our people are really excited. I'm excited. The team's excited. We're going to get them and all this stuff. And we kick off. You know, the opening kickoff crescendo, you know, they're like, ooh, 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 ooh. Whap, we kick the ball. They get the ball, and boom, all the way back. He runs, I think it was Nat Moore, ran it back 100 yards. And now here we were, you know, Black Sunday, Raiders, revenge, Dolphins, get them in Oakland, fans, crazy, team, crazy, good, going to do it. And the opening kickoff in our park, and they run it back all the way. So now it's 7-0, you know, and the fans haven't even sat down yet. I mean, they haven't even, you know, got on the right number yet in their seats, and we're down 7-0. And so that was the first thing I remember. There was an uphill battle, and we fought it uphill all year. And then finally, Stabler threw that pass at the end of the game to Clarence Davis, which worried me because it was a pass that we call a fake trap bootleg. We fake a trap into the middle of the line, then the quarterback bootlegs. And basically, if they drop off to cover the guy in the end zone who's a tight end, then the quarterback can run it in. And if they come up for the quarterback, then the tight end's usually wide open. He throws it. Well, somehow our tight end was covered and didn't get off, and the quarterback was rushed and he had nothing. He finally found. I mean, it was a bad play. And as a coach, it was run towards my side, and I could see some bad things are happening to us because our quarterback can't run it and our tight end's not open. And next thing I knew, he threw a dart in there to Clarence Davis.
There he is, fading, looking, looking, looking. He's under the gun. He's fired. He throws. It is.
Oh, he caught it. He caught it.
No. Unbelievable.
The other most memorable game, or the 10 greatest games, is the 77 playoff, the Raiders and the Colts. And the question I want to ask you about that is, how come that you went for the touchdown in the end of that game rather than maybe go for the field goal?
I always thought that just made sense to me at the time, and it still makes sense to me at the time, that if I go for the touchdown, if I don't get it, I can kick the field goal. I still have a chance. And so, in other words, I'm picking up two. And what I tell my quarterback is, we throw to the corner of the end zone, and I put it in a position where either our guy gets it or it goes out of bounds. I don't throw anything that can be intercepted. So we take a shot at the touchdown. Then if we don't get it, then we take a shot at the field goal. Now, if you do it the opposite, you can't do it the opposite. I can't take a shot at the field goal. If I miss that, they get the ball. It doesn't make any difference what down it is. I mean, if you go for a field goal on second down and you miss a field goal, they get the ball. So it's always just made sense, you know, just the thing that if I can get two chances, one, the end zone and a touchdown, and then two, the field goal, that ups my chances by 50% of winning the game. So a lot of times you'll do that and you'll miss it and kick the field goal and you're not even aware that you do it. But I always believe that. Take your shot, and then if you don't get that, then take the shot at the field goal, but having more than one shot. We had a famous picture of it, became Ghost to the Post. And that was Tom Flores made that call. We had a play we called 91 in, and the flanker, the Z, the outside receiver, runs an in pattern. And on 91 in, the tight end runs a post, and it's usually a clean out. In other words, the tight end runs through deep, the deep part of the zone defense or the defense to take the safety out and then let the end come in. So Tom saw it and saw that as we were bringing the flanker in, which would have been Blitnikoff, that safety was taking a peek at that and was letting Casper get deep or by him. And Casper's name was the Ghost. So Tom Flores, when the defense was on the field, was talking to Snake Stabler on the thing. And he said, Snake, he said somewhere, he said, when you run 91 in, he said, take a peek at Ghost to the post. That's what he said. So now Stabler said, okay, so he runs 91 in. He took a peek and Ghost was wide open on the post. And then that was a big play that got us down there. And then we, went on to win it.
Stabler now sends Branch left, Biletnikoff to the right. Back again, straight drop back, pumps once. He goes medium deep to Casper. Casper makes an over-the-shoulder catch. He's caught from behind at the 15-yard line. A very, very remarkable adjustment as Casper, I think, first turned the wrong way and managed to run under that high lob to the deep part of the defense.
That was a great game. You know, the funny thing about that game, that Baltimore playoff game, it didn't get talked about as one of the great. I mean, if it were a Super Bowl, that game had been a Super Bowl, it'd be the greatest football game ever played. But the fact that it was a playoff game, now, they were out and we had to go play the championship game the next week, no one talked about it. I remember, and as I look back now, it's really sad. We went off the field. We played six periods in that game. And it was a tough game, and we went off the field. You know what we did in the locker room? We were watching the television of the next game. It was Pittsburgh playing Denver to find out who we were going to play for the championship game the next week. And we came in the locker room 2 minutes after, we win what I think is one of the greatest games in history. We're watching the TV set to see who we're going to play next week. The game just kind of got lost.
What about the story of Stabler and that where he came over the sideline? I've heard you tell that story.
Yeah, well, just before that play that, we won the game on, Stabler came over, and I was excited because we had gone, for six periods, and we had things moving, and I could see how we could put them away. So I had all these ideas. Let's do this. We'll go to that. Boom. He goes there. You go there. We'll run. We'll pass. We'll fake. We'll kick. We'll do. And I'm going on and on. I'm hyped, running away, hands are going. So I'm facing the field, and Stabler's facing me, and he's listening. He has his helmet cocked up over his head, and he has one of those water things you squirt water into your mouth. Now, I'll never look. He's kind of looking around, and he says, you know what, John? He goes, boy, he says, these fans are getting their money's worth today, aren't they? I said, you don't worry about the doggone fans. You get in there. Let's get this game. And then the next play, threw the touchdown pass to Casper, and we won the game.
The one game that did not get a name, the Raiders' 1976 playoff game against the Patriots. Before there was the tuck rule game between New England and Oakland, there was Sugar Bear Hamilton and the roughing the passer call. To remind you, in the waning moments of that game, Patriots lineman Ray Sugar Bear Hamilton was flagged for hitting Ken Stabler in the head. The Raiders won. The next week, they finally defeated the Steelers in the AFC Championship game and then went on to win Super Bowl IX over the Vikings, Madden's lone championship. When we come back, we'll hear coaches' thoughts on fellow Raiders legends Ken Stabler, Gene Upshaw, and of course, Al Davis. Stay tuned. Welcome back to NFL Films Tales from the Vault. We've talked about the games with names, but those 70s Raiders teams had characters christened with memorable monikers. There was the Mad Stork, Ted Hendricks. Twos, John Matuszak. Ghost, Dave Casper. The Mad Bomber, Daryl LaMonica. And of course, Snake, Ken Stabler. Those teams led by Madden had this larger-than-life aura. I mean, come on, they even had their own theme song. So as we head back to the interview, after taking us through those memorable games, Steve talks to Coach about those memorable characters of the 70s, beginning with the Snake.
What kind of player was he to Coach, John?
Well, he was great because nothing bothered him. I mean, he, In those years, he had a great mind. He could remember everything. He called his plays, called his own plays. And he didn't have any fear. Rush didn't scare him. And, you know, that's something a lot of people don't talk about. But quarterbacks, most quarterbacks are really scared to death, of the rush. And he didn't have any fear. He wasn't afraid of him. And I mean, he just dared him. He just stood there and dared him.
How about Gene Upshaw?
He and I came at the same time to the Raiders in 1967. He was a number one draft choice, and I was an assistant coach, a linebacker coach, and he played longer than I could coach. And he was really a good leader and a good player, and and did everything. And all offensive linemen hold, but they don't all admit it. And I remember he used to have trouble. Pittsburgh Steelers. He used to have trouble with Ernie Holmes. So we're playing Pittsburgh one day, and we get a drive going, and there's no drive stopper worse than holding. So Upshaw gets a holding penalty, and so that's 15-yard penalty. So now we come back, and we end up, like third and 32 or one of those things when, what the heck do you call? Nothing's going to work. So anyway, so I'm mad when they come off, we have to punt, and I'm getting on Upshaw about holding. He said, I didn't hold. And I said, well, I didn't. And he said, wait till you see the film. So what can you say? So I look at the film, and not only did he hold him, he just grabbed him. I mean, Ernie Holmes got by him, and he just grabbed him by the jersey and then tackled him with the other arm and everything. So he came in after. I was really mad, when they came back. And I said, hey, I said, I want to see you a minute. I said, you told me you didn't hold. I says, you held. And he goes, he was a smart, he's a politician. I mean, he's the head of the players union now. But he goes, and I'm, and I said, I got it. I said, the film. I said, you grab him, you do everything. I said, that was holding. That was bad. And he said, let me ask you a question. He says, you want Snake to get killed? And I said, no. He didn't say, do you want, the guy to get by me. I mean, he says, killed. Well, who do you want to get killed? Heck no. I said, no, I don't want him. He said, okay. He said, that's why I hold him. He said, he was going to kill Snake. He said, if I don't grab him, he said, he killed Snake. He said, you don't want Snake killed, do you? And I said, no, I don't want. He said, okay, then I had to hold him, so it's okay. So he's out the door. So now he goes, and so all the players know that I'd called him in. I was still mad. So now he goes out, and he says, what did he say? What happened? He goes, He tells all the linemen, he said, John said it's okay to hold. It's okay for us to hold. And it took me like a month to get out of that thing. Yeah. That he was, so you want someone killed? Hell no, I don't want anyone killed. Well, then we got to hold if the guy gets by us, so we don't get killed. Yeah. But anyway, that's Upshaw.
Why is it that the Raiders have been so successful for so many years? Is there a reason for that?
I think so. I think a good organization, and I think basically knowing what they want. I remember Vince Lombardi telling me that. I was asking Vince Lombardi once what separates. And it seems like a simple thing, just knowing what you want, know what the end looks like. And a lot of people don't know, but the Raiders know. I mean, they know what they want in their players. So that leads to the type of player they draft. Players have come and gone, and coaches have come and gone, and the one thing that stays there is Al Davis. The fact that he knows the way to win and what has to be done and where you're going. And that helps. It would be, you'd be surprised at the number of people who don't know where they're going, what the end looks like. And I think that's the big thing, is just knowing what they want.
What do you think is the public's biggest misconception of Al Davis?
That he's a bad guy. I mean, Al Davis is Al Davis is a very complex man, and he's a brilliant man, and he's a good guy. But anyone, when you write about someone, or you tell a story on radio or television, everything has to be short or concise. So when you tell a story about a person, you have to simplify it to make it short or concise. And Al Davis is a very complex man, and you can't take a complex person and simplify it. And everyone tries to simplify it and shorten it and say this is what he is. And what they say is probably right, but that's only one very little part of what he is. And they've never gotten a whole. And I mean, I think that you know, just things like if someone were in trouble anywhere, and if someone were in trouble, if someone were sick in this league at any level, any person, and he said to me, who would be the first guy there to help? I'd say it'd be Al Davis. But that part of him is never. I mean, it may be as an afterthought, but that's not part. But he would be.
Madden said you can't simplify a complex man like Al Davis, but I can try to simplify John Madden when I tell you that he was kind, and I speak from personal experience. Let me quickly tell you about two calls I got from Coach in 2018. The first was when I received the Pete Rozelle Award from the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and Coach called to congratulate me and just tell me how proud he was of me. And then a few months later, as I was about to become the first full-time female NFL game analyst commentating Thursday Night Football on Prime Video, John Madden called me and said, how are you doing? I'm so proud of you. I had no idea about this. And I told him, Coach, I'm pretty nervous. And John Madden said to me, don't feel like you have to cram for the test. You've been preparing for this your entire career. I exhaled. And my anxiety level amped down a little bit. But let me tell you, when John Madden tells you something, you better listen and learn from that. And I am forever grateful for Coach's support, especially in that moment of high anxiety. But before we go, here's one last clip from my 1988 interview that I did with Coach. One final bit of insight into what made him special.
I'd like to finish up by talking about you for a minute as Coach. What was your greatest asset, would you say?
I don't know. I never evaluated that. I don't know. I don't even know if I had an asset. I mean, I was just a guy coaching. I mean, I never thought about those things. I really haven't. I was just kind of a working guy who went to work and tried to be the same every day. I mean, I tried to treat everyone with respect and treat them the same.
That's the legendary John Madden. Just a guy coaching, selling, creating, making history. Coach, rest in peace. You are deeply missed. Next week, we're going to bring you one of John Madden's favorite players. Well, to be more accurate, NFL players to be. We opened up the Peyton Manning wing of the NFL Films Vault and found a 1997 interview that Steve did with Peyton when he was in his final season at the University of Tennessee. Sitting alongside his dad, Archie. Talk about a time capsule. I hope you'll join us. Thanks for listening. I'm Andrea Kramer.